Good morning. My name is Norma, and I am an alcoholic with a cold. I'd like to thank Bill Hay for asking me to come and share my experience, strength, and hope in beautiful Oklahoma City. And I had such a lovely time with Sherry. She was a wonderful, wonderful host. And I am so amazed that no matter where we are all an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so, so grateful. I want to welcome the newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to let you know it works. It works good, and it works slow, right? Everything I'm going to say this morning is my opinion only. I don't know if this is the way my life went down, but it's the way I see it. You can tell I'm a Mexican, right? Well, I'm of the Mexican variety that my family had parties Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And in the olden days, they didn't buy six packs or cases of beer. They bought kegs of beer. You know, and I believe I was born an alcoholic. I also believe I was born a liar, a cheat, and a manipulator. That comes natural to me. And when I was a kid, they thought it was cute to give us all a glass of beer. And I used to go from relative to relative to get me that keg beer. I loved the way keg beer tasted. And they used to keep it in the bathtub with those big blocks of ice and those chunks of salt. So I'd go in there and put me some foam. I loved the foam. I loved the way keg beer tasted. We used to live behind my grandmother's house. And when I was a little girl, the first feeling I ever remember feeling was fear. I was terrified of my mother. You see, I had an older sister, and she used to get to sleep with my mother. And I remember I used to sleep in a little walk-in closet. And I used to wake up in the middle of the night, crying and yearning for my mama. I didn't understand why I didn't get to sleep with my mother. I always felt unloved and unwanted when I was a little girl. The truth of the matter is I wet the bed. That's why I didn't get to sleep with my mother. But when you're 4 years old, you don't know that's the reason. I just felt unloved, unwanted, and rejected. I had, like I said, I lived behind my grandmother's house, and I adored my grandmother. For me, my grandmother never could do no wrong. I was also a battered child. But let me tell you what kind of kid I was. When I was little, they never allowed us to have potato chips or cookies or candy. Well, my grandmother always had a 2-pound box of See's candy in the refrigerator. So when nobody was around, I'd go in there and I'd start slamming it in my face. Yeah, that's still how I eat it today. And my mother would show up and she'd say, Norma, did you eat that chocolate? And I'd say, no. And she'd start giving me that rapid fire. No, I didn't eat it. I didn't eat it. I swear I didn't eat it. She'd grab me by my arm, take me to the mirror, and there'd be chocolate all over my face. And I don't know how it got there. You see, I would lie under any and all conditions. My head said the price I would pay for telling the truth would be so much greater than if I hung on to the lie. So I never told the truth. At any cost, I hung on to what I stuck to my story. When I was 8 years old, I had my first blackout drunk. We moved to Mira Loma, which is country living. And we had a 3-day baptism. I remember it was Friday, and then it was Sunday. And I remember it was a Sunday morning about 1 or 2 in the afternoon, and I was walking around the house, and I could hear them inside talking about me, about how I had gotten so drunk and who had given me so much. And that was the first time I ever felt shame and remorse. I didn't know what I did, but I knew it was bad. I'm also a recovering Catholic. If there's any Catholics in here. But in the olden days, you used to go into this room and tell the priest your sins. Well, I'd go in there and I'd tell him I might have lied once or twice or stole a half a time. I wasn't going to tell him anything either. And I remember in the morning, you're supposed to take a little host and not supposed to eat before you take that host. I always ate just to see what God's going to do, right? They said God was going to punish me. It didn't matter who I was testing. I was always testing somebody. You know, when I was little and we lived on this ranch, my dad was gone a lot. You know, my mother was an alcoholic, and when I was a kid, they used to say that my daddy was in college. Well, the truth of the matter is he was a heroin addict, and he was in the joint a lot. And I remember when my mother used to, when she used to beat us, after she'd come back and she would apologize and she'd cry and she'd love on us. And she used to always tell us that my daddy loved us so much, but he was so, so sick. But you see, my mother never cleaned it up for herself, you see. With all the violence and all the stuff, I had such a mixed message about love. You see, I used to look for my mama and my daddy in the cupboards and in the barn. I used to think that someplace, somewhere, they were gagged and that this was another person running around here because she was so loving, but yet she was so violent. When I was 10 years old, my mother moved us to Pomona. My mother got sober when I was 10 years old. She moved us to Pomona where the girls ratted their hair up, wore tight skirts in the fifth grade, okay? Where before we lived in farmland, and you know, there was no neighbors a mile that way. There was nobody. I mean, there was absolutely nobody to play with. And we moved to Pomona, and these girls used to wait for us every day after school to give us our initiation. And I'd cry to the teacher, they're going to beat us up. Well, on the last day of school, the guys and the girls cornered my sister and they jumped her. And I remember I ran and I flagged down a car. And they went and they got my sister out of there. And we went home and we told my mom what had happened. And my mother got on the phone and she started calling the school district. And she made sure that the next semester my sister got to go to another school. And one more time, I wasn't loved enough. One more time, I wasn't good enough because I had to go back to that school. My mother was a great AA-er. She went to meetings every day from 7:30 to 10 o'clock. Mama was at the meeting. From 7:30 to 9:45, we had the boys over. We were doing a little spray paint, a little glue. My drug of choice is whatever you got, we doing, right? And every now and then, Mama would come home early from the meeting, and she'd discover the guys there, and all of us would get our butts whipped that day. And anyway, what happened is I'm also a Mexican reject. I wasn't raised on beans and rice and tortillas. I was raised on pot pies, TV dinners, and bologna sandwiches. And that's still my diet today. My mother made beans one time, and she put spinach in it, okay? But it tasted very good. And when my mother got sober, she decided to go on a diet. So we started having carrots and celery, no bread, and that nasty diet Shasta soda with that saccharin, with that aftertaste. Anyway, so I used to do these little burglaries to eat at other people's houses. I never thought about stealing their stuff. I just went over there to eat. And what happened is I was in the sixth grade, and in the olden days they had those double desks. Well, the girl I shared my desk with was a white girl. I wasn't intimidated by white. I was intimidated by the Mexicans. You see, because I never felt Mexican enough. I didn't take a burrito. I didn't speak Spanish. You know, then, I speak Spanish now. Anyway, I shared my desk with this white girl, and we had a little fight, and they called her a monkey, and she took it personal. And so when I went to go do this little eating excursion, when I'm coming back to school, and she's coming down the playground with a couple of her friends. She's coming to confront me, right? And her mouth starts to move like my mother's, and it starts perspiring up here. Next thing I know, I hit her, I broke her arm, I blacked out, and all those cholas said, "Don't cry, Norma, wait till you get to the bathroom." You see, finally, somebody was going to pay for the things that were going on in my house, you see. Not only was I a victim to my mother, but I was also a victim to my sister. At home, I was a victim. At home, I was meek and silent and terrified. And that day, I learned to be a victimizer. And all the girls were my friends now. So I started running my hair up. Started taking in my mother's skirts and wearing those little tiny diamond nylons in the sixth grade, okay? And watch Hobo Kelly, you know? As I'm doing this, you know, I was resentful of Hobo Kelly. She never saw anything for me in the dryer. I know why she didn't see anything. because I'm a Mexican. They didn't find anything for the Mexicans. Anyway, I got into a lot of trouble at school. You know, I became somebody at school. That's when my life actually took a split. And my mother moved us to the other side of Pomona. You know, the book talks about seeking lower companions. I took 3 buses to get to the ghetto. I was the best dressed chola in the barrio. That's what we call a ghetto. Not only that, but all the girls wanted to be my friend. Why? Because I had money and I'd buy them. Not only that, if they had a problem, I'd take care of it. I had a lot of suppressed anger and willing to share it. And, so what happened is we kept doing this geographic of my mother's sobriety. I've been to hundreds and hundreds of AA meetings. I'm also a product of Alateen. And, we moved to the other side of Montclair. And I decided to join the drill team. I'm the kind of person that can fit in with any kind of clique. So I joined drill team, and one day when I'm going to go smoke a cigarette in the bathroom, all the girls are talking about this guy. He's 6'3", blonde hair, blue eyes. He has a nice car and a car show, and he's not in school, and all the girls wanted him. You know I had to have him. Anyway, I married this guy. And he introduces me to Boone's Farm Apple Wine and Reds. Oh, my God. I thought I was violent before. As soon as I got that combination, it was on. You know, I don't think I know any social drinkers that take a sleeping pill with their alcohol. Anyway, what happened is I married this guy who went to a house party, and he was going to the liquor store. And when he was coming through the door with his bag, a chick was coming through the door with a bag, too. I looked over there. I knew he was with her. I picked up a beer bottle, broke it on his face just in case. Shortly after that, I tried to kill him again. And when he gets out of the hospital, his family sends him up to Ontario, Canada. And when I get out of juvenile hall, I swear I'm going to kill this guy. Now, I'm from Montclair. I've never been out of California. But this was during the time when everybody was hitchhiking. You know, and so I started thumbing it from Montclair. So I'm going to go to Ontario, Canada and kill this guy, right? So I thumb it and I get as far as Columbus, Ohio. I want you to know there are no Mexicans in Columbus, Ohio. But I'll tell you what. I started partying. I started having fun. I forgot what my primary purpose was. And something happened in my home, and I came back to Montclair, and I thought, you know what? I got to get rid of that wine and those reds. That stuff makes me too, too violent. I know what I need. I need to get me a job and buy myself a 64 Chevy. You know the kind with a big steering wheel? Why did I buy a little 6-inch because I can't see over the top? Get rid of that wine. Just switch to a little 151 Bacardi and RC Cola. God, I love Bacardi and RC Cola. By then we moved to Orange County, and I'm hanging out in Ontario. Ontario is about 45 minutes from Orange County, and that's where I'm claiming that I'm from. I'm from Orange County. And this is during the time when we used to ride our hair real high and put those cascades in there with a big hair. Get as high as you can get it. And you wear those double eyelashes, you know those big eyelashes? And wear all those lines. We used to go over there and beat up the girls from out of town. I was from out of town. And the next day we'd go pick up our hair where they pulled it out. I'd do this thing over and over again. What I call Sunday is a normie's Monday, 3 o'clock in the morning. But Sunday at 3 o'clock in the morning when I'm coming back to go home because I have to go to work on Monday morning, right? When I get home, I drop me a little white. Or if I'm lucky, a few black beauties, so I can hear the alarm, because if I go, I'll pass out. So I'm laying down, I'm trying to hurry up and go to sleep, the room's spinning, you know, it's just going round and round, and want to hurry up and fall asleep before they kick in. And it seems like I just barely close my eyes, and the alarm goes off, and I wake up and I got the shakes, and I'm 17 years old, and I got the shakes, and I drag myself to the bathroom, and I got that taste in the morning, you know. and I go to the bathroom to brush my teeth. Nothing serious. I just give it a little quickie because it makes me gag, you know. And, you know, I'm reeking of all that 151 Bacardi. So you know I need to take a shower, but I don't. I just add a little perfume nobody will notice, right? And drop a little few winter life savers, right? We'll go to work. I never considered myself a morning drinker, but I'll tell you what. At lunchtime, when all the guys were going to go have an 80-ouncer, I was right there with them. I would have that. I would drink that beer just to get me through the day. You know, I remember the first time I gave my mother her year cake. See, I was very, very resentful with Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not stand Alcoholics Anonymous because we always went to picnics. We always went to potlucks, and we always went to this, and we always went to that. But that wasn't the bad part. The bad part is I'd be standing there, and somebody would come up to me and say, "You're Auntie's daughter, aren't you?" And I'd say, "Yes." And she goes, "So how's that problem in school?" God, I'd get so mad. Why is my mom telling them everything? And that's none of their business. I couldn't stand Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember when my mom got up to the podium, and me and my sister gave her her first year cake. And she got up here, and she was saying how wonderful things had changed. I looked over at my sister, and I said, "Well, the real Angie, please stand up." You see, because I expected AA to cure her. I expected AA to stop the violence, I had this illusion of what a mother should be. And I thought AA was supposed to make her be that. So I couldn't stand AA. I didn't want nothing to do with AA. So, you know, when I'm doing this drinking, what happened is, you know, at the beginning I started drinking Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then it went to Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Wednesday, hump day, right? Then it went to Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, and then Wednesday, and then Thursday. Well, anyway, on one of the off days, you know, like a dumb Tuesday, you know, my cousin asked me to come over, wanted to know if I wanted to go over to his in-law's house. He said they were going to go and have a little party. And I don't think I had anything to drink that day, maybe just that beer. And that day I had a shot of whiskey. And I blacked out. And the next day, my cousin's wife, who did not drink, came over to my house and said that I had been all over a cousin of mine, that I had been sitting on his lap and stroking his hair. And I cringed at the idea because I hated him. Because when I was a little girl, he was always trying to molest me, and I was terrified of him. So when she told me that, you know, I heard some stuff here, you know, and I got rid of that. I said, "Oh, no." So I started jogging 7-10 miles a day. I quit drinking. You know, I decided to broaden my horizon. It's just like chapter 3. You know, I started jogging 7-10 miles a day. I started reading that other inspirational book. I decided to go to college and broaden my thoughts, right? I started taking a hard class like political science. I didn't drink for 3 years, but I smoked a little weed. You know, weed ain't bad. It's natural. It's out of the ground. I'd smoke a joint to take that right before that final, take that political class and read the same sentence over and over. Get an F. Next semester, sitting in the same seat, same instructor, same great notes, never miss a day of class. Smoke a joint before the final, get stuck on the same sentence over and over. I took that class 4 semesters in a row. Same seat, same instructor, same behavior, same F. And I remember when I walked out of that class, I said, "I know what the problem is. The problem is I'm stupid." My mother always said I was stupid, and I believed her. I didn't know it was Louise when I got sober. Anyway, what happened is I hadn't drank for 3 years. I was just on that weed maintenance. I'll do anything to keep from being an alcoholic. You know, it says we can increase the list at infinitum. And what happened is my girlfriend brought these two guys over, and they were talking, and I had a shot of tequila, and then I had 2 pints. And she asked him where he lived. He said, "Someplace by the Orange Circle." My mother lived by the Orange Circle. I had a few resentments with that lady. There was a baseball bat by me, picked up the bat, beat the shit out of my girlfriend, destroyed the furnished apartment. The cops came, got in a physical confrontation with the cops. The guys left, ran out the door, knocked on the landlady's door and said, pray for me as they're taking me to jail. And it had been 3 years since I had a drink. And in the olden days, they used to put you in this little rubber room and let you sleep it off. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, they came and they got me up. And I remember my eye was gone. You know, I had a shiner here. My eye was gone. And my hair was all thrashed. My nylons were all ripped. I didn't have any shoes on. I didn't have any money. And I remember I stopped at the bus, and the bus driver let me on the bus. And I remember seeing all you guys ready to go to work, bright-eyed and chipper. And I said, you know what? You know, I think there might be a little problem here. And I swore off. What I did is I switched to a little social heroin. You know, heroin don't stay social very long. You see, I was always looking for something. And what happened is, like I said, I am a victimizer. I know just who I can victimize. I'm a victim, but I'm a victimizer. And what happened for me is that, you know, the book talks about incomprehensible demoralization. And I started renting my grandmother's house. My grandmother had a 3-bedroom home in which I lived in, and she lived not close to my house, so she wasn't seeing what I was doing. So what I was doing is I was renting that house to illegal aliens. I figured if they told on me, I'd call immigration, right? Well, I rented it to so many families, and they all got together and they told on me. And when I got out of jail, I had absolutely no place and nowhere to go. You see, I had long since burned all my bridges. I used up all my family, all my friends. And when I got out of that jail, I had no place to go. You know, and I started put all my belongings in the shopping cart. I was 28 years old, and I got sober when I was 34. And that's when my life turned a drastic change. That's when my disease really went to the pit. I put all my things in a shopping cart, and I started living that life, living on the streets. You know, I never sold my body out there because I didn't think anybody would buy it. I weighed 76 pounds. I wore a size 7 little girl. I put all my eyebrows out, all my eyelashes out. I had sores all over my face and all up and down my arm because after heroin quit working, I incorporated a little cocaine into the action. I just didn't know what I was seeking, but I was seeking something. And I used to always think there was bugs in my eyes, so I would try to get them with the tweezers. And I was always that kind of alcoholic that talked to themselves. You know, I didn't see any homeless people here in Oklahoma, but in Los Angeles, there's a lot of homeless people. They have signs. I wish I knew about the signs. I bet you I would have made me some bucks with that sign. You see, I know what it is to sit on my spine, to be that thin and to sit on my spine. I know what it is to try to use a restroom in a gas station and they tell you it's out of order. I know what it is for somebody to want to buy you food and they tell you you have to wait outside. That wasn't my goal in life. That's not what I wanted to be. I know that wasn't what my mom wanted for me. You see, I started pushing my cart out there. I started living with the ladies of the night so they could take care of me. I used to go, I remember there would be times I'd be up all night long, and I'd be so empty and so lonely and so full of pain. And all I wanted was a little warm toast and a little oatmeal. So I'd go and stand in the line at 3 o'clock in the morning waiting for the free lines. And I remember I'd be walking down for that toast, and I'd get me some cold toast. And I'd be hollering and screaming, don't they know I've been there all night long? And they 86 me from the Salvation Army eating lines. I was always a victim when I lived on the streets. I used to do my shopping on other people's clotheslines. I used to steal their children's clothes because I wore a size 7 little girls. I never thought I was all that bad. And what happened for me is I went to jail. I've been to jail many, 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 many times, at least 13. And I'm the only one that I know that would cry when it was time to leave. You see, because I didn't know what was going to become of me when I hit the streets again. I didn't know where I was going to go. And every time I was in jail, I'd swear, I'm not going to do this again. Every time I was in jail, I'd call my mom up and tell her I was going to be different. It was going to be different. But something would happen when I'd hit that Sally Port. And I would do it one time. I owed it to myself one time. And it starts a vicious cycle again. And this one time, my crime partner was going to prison. And she said, you better call your mom and ask for some help. So I called my mother up, and like I said, I called her many, many times. And she said, for God's sake, Norma, I'm making dinner for Johnny Harris. If you want to get sober, you write to this place in Indio. I never heard of Indio. But let me tell you about Indio. It's all sand and tumbleweeds. My goodness. Anyway, when I got out of jail, they let me out about 1 o'clock in the morning. And all the girls are going to the 7-Eleven to get some cookies. You know how the book talks about impending doom? Well, when I was going to the 7-Eleven, that's what I felt. I had 23 days without any substance in my body, and I felt that impending doom. And I ran back to that jail, and I called the lady that was supposed to pick me up. And she picked me up, and she took me halfway there, and then my mom picked me up. And she said that stuff you say to those you love. She said, Norma, give yourself a break. This can be the last time you ever go through this. And she's going on, and I'm shrinking there, feeling 5 years old again. Anyway, when I was in jail, I was telling everybody that I was going to Betty Ford. The mama said she was going to send me to the best recovery home that she knew. I told them I was going to be stunning and muddy with Elizabeth Taylor. I told you what I look like. I would have never fit in with Elizabeth Taylor. Anyway, when we're getting off the freeway, there's all this sand and all this tumbleweed. It looks bad over there. I think we're going to central office and then up to the Betty Ford, the sun and mud, you know. And anyway, we pull in front of this two-story place and nobody's there, so we roll around down the alley. But one side is a shooting gallery. That's an old, beat-up old houses where homeless people live. And the other side, there were 4 cats. Everybody knows what cat means. It means mice. I go, shoot, I got loaded in better places than this. And I always remember AA as being a bunch of old people. I remember I used to sit in the meetings and love to hear their exciting stories. What I thought was they had a lot of good time, and now they don't have no place else to go, so now they're here, right? So bigger than Hootenanny, here comes this old lady down the steps. She tells me to sleep on the couch and don't use the phone. You know, all night I'm thinking, who can I call? Somebody get me out of here. But there was absolutely no place and nowhere for me to go. And I remember when that sweet old woman who had passed away, and she was from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. And when that sweet old woman took me into her office, And she was doing my intake. She asked that question you're not supposed to ask to arrogant people. She asked me what my drug of choice was. And I said, heroin. And she said, did you ever use alcohol? And I said, yes. And she said, can you see how your alcoholism led you to try other things? And that was my first moment of clarity. She goes, therefore we identify ourselves as an alcoholic. We no longer want to be different. The person that might save your life that day might just be an alcoholic and not relate to the other. She said, you get a sponsor and you work the steps. I got a sponsor who had 27 years of sobriety. I wanted someone who knew some stuff. Not only that, but my mother had 23 and a half years of sobriety and my sister had 8 years and I didn't want a day they had. I didn't even know what they had, but I didn't want it. Anyway, I got this sponsor and I started working the steps. And, you know that part about insanity? You know, I ate out of trash cans, but not that bad trash cans. You know, none of that dumpster stuff. Just good hotel trash, you know, Best Western, Quality Inn, good trash cans. I was not a dumpster diver. Anyway, you know, I didn't think I was crazy. It didn't matter that I talked to myself. It didn't matter that I used to fight with invisible people. It didn't matter that I thought there was women underneath the bed. I didn't think I was crazy. And, you know, and then that part about, you know, step three, come to believe a part of myself to restore me to sanity and make a decision. Well, somewhere, I remember I was walking, it must have been about noon, I was walking through that clubhouse. And somewhere, somehow, something came to me and said, you know, Norma, you've been a phony all your life. Just pretend there's something. And in the desert, it's very windy. So I chose the wind as my God. I could hear it move the trees. I could see it dust up the sand. I could feel it on my skin. And I started to say that that was my God. I couldn't see it, but I could see what it could do. And in the morning, I'd say, please keep me sober today. And in the nighttime, I said, thank you. I asked God not to remove that obsession. I never said the word God. You see, because when I was little and God didn't bring my daddy back, I swore never to pray to him. I was never one of those persons that went to jail and said, God, get me out of this. God never passed before my lips. And when I was in that recovery home and I chose the wind as my God, every time it touched my face, I acknowledged that that was him. And I started working my steps and, you know, I had a lot of resentments with my mother. When I was 8 months sober, they let me have a little job. And I used to work in a little hardware store. And on November 27th of 1989, we were removing the artificial Christmas trees. We were getting ready to set up for the holidays. I was the only woman that worked at this hardware store. And the assistant manager took me upstairs to take the Christmas trees out. So I'm complaining, I'm yelling, why did they have to take me? I'm the only girl, get one of the guys. So resentfully, I'm walking up the stairs, he tells me where to, I start moving a Christmas tree resentfully, and I'm going further and further into the attic. And as I go a little further, the floor gives way, and I fall two stories. And then, you know, they have these metal shelves, and when I'm falling through the ceiling, I slam into those metal shelves, and I'm going so fast, I bend the shelf, and I spring back up, and I fall down the rest of the way, and I land on my feet both times. And that day, I knew that God had a plan for me. That day, all doubt removed. All the doubts were removed that there was a higher power of sorts, and he had a plan for me. I didn't break anything, just a few teeth, but they were probably on the rot anyway. And that's when my life began to change. That's when I knew that God had a plan for me. When I was 8 months sober, that grandmother that I adored died. And I got mad at God. I said, take my mama, take my sister, two for one, but give me my grandma back. You see, because even though I got to make my amends to my grandmother, I wasn't done loving on her. I wasn't ready for her to go. And when God takes something away, he always replaces it with something else. And what I had to do is I had to get the piece of paper and the pen, and I had to do 5 more inventories on my mother and my sister so I could let them off the hook. Because I have such a great expectation on them. I wasn't willing to let go of my blankie, of all my resentments I have. And when I forgot to tell you, I had 7 affairs my first year and a half of sobriety. It'd been a long time since anybody noticed me, believe me. And you know what I learned from that? That it is the attraction. You see, because you guys look too together. When I was a newcomer and I was sitting in those seats, I didn't know what was going to become of me. You looked too clean, too right. I felt too dirty. I didn't feel like I belonged. And it made me feel so good. And I listened to them, and they talked Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember there was a woman who took me to my first woman stag out of that recovery home. And it was all predominantly white. It was in Palm Springs. And in the middle of the meeting, she gets up, and she's serving coffee. And I said, uh-huh. They make the Mexicans serve the coffee, right? And she said, no, Norma, we are of service because we are grateful, because we help each other. And now, so what happened is I moved back to Los Angeles. See, I failed to tell you that I was in a 12-year relationship when I was having those affairs. And I thought just because I'd call up and break up, that was enough. But you know, our chip says, to thy own self be true. You know, and also that the good is the enemy of the best, is what Bill W. wrote. And I will try to mend that 12-year relationship. I stayed in that relationship for 5 more years to mend. And I'm also here to tell you, don't get all your loved ones back just because you get sober. And I tried very hard to mend that relationship, and I could not. I moved to Los Angeles, and I became self-supporting through my own contributions. I started practicing the principles that I was taught in that recovery home and Alcoholics Anonymous in the desert. And what happened is I had this little, this job. I worked in a storage facility. And I remembered that I was the manager there, and we needed to get the water in L.A. is terrible. So I ordered some Arrowhead water. And they wouldn't deliver Arrowhead water because I was the manager. My TRW was a mess. I didn't even know I went to the hospital so many times. I had a $60 gas bill when gas bills were a dollar. I mean, I can't even imagine. I had all this stuff on my TRW. So I had to start paying them one at a time. You know, it took me 3 years to clean up my TRW. And I remember when I had to make an amends to a girlfriend of mine. And now when my grandmother passed away, she left me a little money. So I remember I was going to her house and I was singing and I was thanking God for allowing me to be willing to do it. And when I get to her house, I'm knocking on the door, right? And she says, get away from here. We don't want your kind here. I just remembered I owed her some money and I was shaking there and I paused. And it's so good that God doesn't reveal everything to you, because then I remembered. You know, when you live on the streets, when you're homeless for such a long time, you know, the cops stop you, they give you a ticket and you go to jail and then you get out on jail and you get a few warrants and the cop comes around again and he asks you your name, you know you got a few warrants. So I gave her name and she's who I thought of, right? So they picked up, she got picked up on a few felony beefs I had picked up in her name. So that's why she didn't want to open the door. So when I knocked on the door, I paused and I asked God to help me. And I knocked on the door and she said, and I told her what I was doing there. I said that I wasn't there to win her friendship, that I was only there to right the wrong I had done. And she opened the door. And I went inside and I told her what I was doing there as outlined in the book. I was told her that I was only there to right the wrong I did. Her family came and I made my amends to them, but they wouldn't take my money. So, you know, I went home, I was all happy, I had extra money, right? And 2 weeks later, she calls me up and she wants the money, right? So now I'm resentful. Why didn't she take the money when I was offering it to her? I had to call my sponsor and tell her, now they want the money, they should have taken it back then. And you know how sponsors are, they always be ruining stuff. She says, Norma, give her the money. You're only holding it for them. You know, I believe that God looks at my defects of character like you when you have a little baby puppy. You know how you have a little baby puppy and you hug it and you hold it so close and it smells like bologna and it grunts. And in the nighttime you make him a little place to sleep and you give him a little blankie. And in the morning when you get up, he's made baby poo-poo and slammed his foot in it. Why do they put their foot in it? Anyway, you just clean up the little poo-poo and you love on him and you send him on the way. And I believe that that's how God looks at my defects of character, because without him, I will not make a change. What happened is at my job, I was there 5.5 years and the company got sold and they told me they were going to keep me. The new owners told me they were going to keep me. And an hour before the takeover, they gave me my severance pay. And I felt lied to. I didn't know what was going to become of me. So I gathered all my belongings, and I went to my house, and I was crying. And I went, and as soon as I got into my house, I got on my knees, and I thanked God for allowing me to experience the pain. You see, I'm so quick to thank him for the good, but not for the pain. And I remembered what Mother Teresa said. She says, God doesn't give you more than you can handle, but she wished she didn't have so much confidence in her. I knew what she meant that day, because see, I had made a conscious decision to end that relationship, because the good is the enemy of the best. And I'm always willing to stay in something that's good and not what's the best for me. And so then, you know, I said, like, what's going to become of me? Because I thought that job was who I was. I thought that relationship was who I was. And I remember that, you know, it seemed so dark, but I knew there was light. And I started to go to more meetings. I loved staying home. I loved to go to new meetings, go together with the girls out to eat. I love that stuff. But you know how sponsors are. They'd be telling you like things like, we're self-supporting through our own contributions. And I tell her, I'm self-supporting. It's my savings, my unemployment. She goes, what is it, Mama? I go, it's my savings. She goes, and that's what you do, you save it. I want you to put 3 resumes a day. So I'm going through the paper all resentful. You know, I get 3 places I don't want to work for. And I fax them my resume. I know you guys aren't that bad. And this guy calls me up. This guy interrupts a phone call that I'm on, right, with one of my friends. Tells me about a job. Like, I'm not interested in doing that. Thank you for asking. I hang up. Go on about my business. 2 weeks later, he calls me up again. And he tells me that he's going to go to a seminar. And it costs him 300 and some bucks. And he'd be willing to pay for me. So, you know, I always got a worm. I figure I'll go make some points. See, I'm going to any man for my sponsor. You know, he's trying to make those brownie points. And anyway, so I go to this seminar from like 8 to 5. And he takes me to his office after it's done. And he tells me, so what do you think? And I said, that sounds okay. I go, but how much does it pay? And he tells me. And I said, oh, no, I can't work for that. I need $400 more a month. He goes, okay. And he goes, when can you start? I go, I need a 2-week vacation. He goes, okay. So about 3 days before I was supposed to start work, I tell him I want to start on April Fool's Day. I figure the joke will be on him. So he lets me start on that day. Anyway, this last April 1st, I celebrated 3 years at that job. And what that shows me is that I don't know what's good for me. God has a plan for everything and anything I do. Everything has a lesson. And I try to sell cars, but I was giving the cars away. Somebody go buy a car and I tell them, oh, no, there's $400 in that sticker price. Don't give them that. Don't offer them this. I made a lot of people a great deal, and I made no money, you know. And, you know, a lot of wonderful things have happened to me since I've been sober. I have gotten to live 2 lifestyles in 1 lifetime. I never did a good deed to deserve this. It's been for free and for fun. I would have never imagined my life to be this good. When I lived on the streets, I never thought I could ever get back. You know, and it's only through a loving God that brought me to you, and you showed me God. Thank you.